Imagine being forced to walk 100 miles across the hot Sacramento Valley and over steep mountains on your way to an alien land. You are still weak after drinking bad water 9 days ago at Stony Creek. You can walk, but you are occasionally forced along by a soldier's bayonet. You feel you are one of the lucky ones, captured 2 weeks ago and held prisoner at Chico. Many of the older people and children on this journey are not so fortunate. Some had been held in Chico for nearly a year. Many are exhausted and frail from fever. So we're here today to talk with Ronnie Hostler and Sandra Knight about an event that happened in California history known as the Gnome Cult Walk. So, Ronnie, what is Gnome Cult and what happened?
Gnome Cult goes way back in 1865, 63, around in that area. I'm not really a history person, but from what I read, that's the only way I'm old, but I don't remember a lot of the stuff that's been written, but that's all I know about it. It's, you know, and there's some people here in the valley that has, elders, that ancestors that were alive when they were really young babies, like, but just reading all that, probably what you've been reading is it all started with the gold rush that they came in and started gathering up all the Indian people, families, and they put them in camps until they decided that they had to get them out of the valley. But it was in 1953, we had a centennial celebration here in the valley. Our people here, they had a big play with what now we call the Methodist Church. They had a big play there and they replayed by the Indians being driven over the mountain, and they had a really beautiful play that a lot of young kids my age don't even remember that. And a lot of them do, but they haven't said anything about it. But from then, from that time till 26 years ago, nothing was ever said about it. I mean, it was just forgotten. Or I know that's what I think about it. They forgot about it, and I didn't. I knew we had the centennial, but so now today, 26 years ago, we had a gentleman that worked for the forestry, Galen Asbel, and Alberta McLean, and I don't know who else was involved with it, but they started working with the forestry department from over on that side and decided that they're went back and got all, I don't know how long it took them to get that history, but they got it and put it together.
Okay, and that's the history that's in this pamphlet?
Yeah, that's all I know about it. You know, even when we did the play, I did that play at the reservation school at that time, I still didn't understand why we were driven in. We were all in front of an elder who passed, but he was on a horse and he drove us into the playground, plaything there, you know. And I think a lot of kids like my age at the time, like 7 years old, didn't understand what that was all about.
Yeah, so essentially the Gnome Cult Trail is the trail that the state of California, along with some of the U.S. cavalry, I believe, marched Northern California natives from Chico, from different tribes, from Chico all the way out to Round Valley, correct?
Yes.
And So in September, there's going to be a commemoration walk, right?
Yes. That started, like I was saying before, we had a young man here, Galen Aswell, and Alberta McLean, worked with the forestry department over on that side and put together all the history. I don't know where it came from, where that history came from or who wrote it.
Okay, so what is going to happen in September with this commemorative walk?
First, I'd tell you about the first time that we started walking, 26 years ago. We had a big meeting over in Pasquena with the forestry department, and there were several people there. I mean, there was a whole bunch of people there from Covelo. So they had speakers, and went over the, what was going to happen on this walk. This was our first time we walked. So we all, after the meeting, we went down 4 miles out of Pasquena and all gathered up and started walking over the hill. That was 26 years ago. That's when we first started doing the walk. We left from Pasquena. And after that, the following years, we started from Chico, and then we changed it to the Bidwell Park Cat alongside the river. So this September, on the 11th, we're going to meet at Buckhorn and start our journey over the hill, providing the situations that we're in right now with the virus and the fires and the smoke and whatever else is going to try to stop us.
So you may not be able to walk because of the smoke this year?
It's a tentative thing, but we're still preparing because we don't know. We're about 3 weeks more to go, so we're still ready to go. As long as we have permission to walk the roads, and we don't know what the forestry is going to do.
All right. So you've been participating in this for the whole 26 years?
26 years, but I took a year off when my mom passed away. The 1 year I didn't walk or she passed away, it was really hard to... Because she walked with me that couple of years before she passed away. So,
how long of a walk is this?
We'll start on the 13th. It's on a Sunday, and we get here on the 18th. Saturday, we'll hit Round Valley on the 18th, which is Saturday. So we walk anywhere from 25 to 30 miles a day. The longest walk would be from Bidwell Park to what we call a cemetery on the other side of I-5. We walk to there. Then we walk from there another 25 miles to what we call Newville. We spend 3 nights at the Buckhorn Campground. Then we stop at Black Bear. Then we camp at Log Springs. And then we hit Wells Cabin. And eventually we head down to Eel River Campground. And from there, Saturday morning, we walk into the tribal buildings in Long Valley.
So how many people are you expecting to participate this year?
Well, when we first started, we were adding around 60, maybe 70 people because we had a lot of big families that were really walking with this, but we lost so many elders since then that the last time we walked, we only had about 7 or 8 walkers. But the 25th year, we canceled because of the virus and the fires on that mountain. We canceled that 25th year, so we just went ahead and called ourselves a 26th year for this year, but hopefully we can still do it.
So out of the 26 years you've been doing this, what has that experience been like, actually retracing the steps of such a harrowing experience for your ancestors?
Well, the first five years, we had a gentleman who would only let us speak, wouldn't let nobody speak but him. So it was kind of like a, I don't know what it was, what you would call it, but I call it a dictator, but maybe that's not the right word to call anybody. But when the media was coming to cover us, we were told not to talk to anybody. If anybody wanted to talk, send them to him. So we were all pretty quiet about it. So we made it. But, you know, walking through that valley, it's really emotional because we're walking for our ancestors. We're really emotional because you can picture what our today way we walk, and then you can just think about how they had to walk, no shoes, the way, just really hard for them to even survive, you know. And it's more sad to think that 400 or 500 started out and only 277 made it to the valley. So you can feel the presence all the way over that hill, even though we're not even on the real trail that they traveled on. So it's really emotional. And I, when you get up, you start walking over that hill, you get up to certain points up there and you look back and you can see that valley and you can imagine how those, our ancestors felt when they looked back. They could picture where their homes were, their reservations, wherever they were at in that valley. You can just feel how they felt when they looked at that. But then when you get up to what we call now Wells Cabin, you get up there on that hill there, and when you get up there, you look down, and you can see the valley. Some places you can see the valley, and then you wonder, you think about how they felt when they could see how away from their nation was, and they didn't know what they were going to, where they were going to be at when they got down there. It's so painful.
Yeah, it sounds like a very powerful experience. So is it essentially a quiet prayer walk, like a solitude walk, or are you all talking with each other along the way?
We visit on the way. We take breaks, and we do a morning circle every morning, and we do our prayer, and every morning we do that. And like I said, for a while there, we were all, we only had one speaker. So when we got, after 5 years, we got up to a Wells Cabin where we were looking at the valley, looking down the hill. I did a thing up there where I picked up a stick and I called it a prayer stick. And I let them know that I wanted everyone to say how they felt. And it was a really emotional circle at that time, because people really broke down and told how they felt. And that was, we do, and from then we do that every time we come to Wells Cabin. That is a sacred circle that we do right there.
So who participates in this walk? Can anybody? Do you have to be Northern California native or from one of the tribes that were actually force marched originally?
Well, we invite everyone. Anyone that wants to walk with us are more than welcome. But when they do, we explain that you're responsible for yourself. There are certain things we can't do. We don't want to be done, and that's drugs and alcohol. And we've been pretty fortunate to have a lot of good people walk with us. A lot of good, great people. And again, it got to the point where we said, we call ourselves a non-cult family when we start out. That means we have to take care of each other, and we watch out for, and we help each other all the way over that hill. And that's, we share our food. That's what we do when we head over. When we start out as a family.
So when you, how would anybody that might want to do this walk, how would they find out about how, you know, how to sign up or who to contact and where to be the first day?
We put out flyers every year, and everybody's welcome. We're not discriminating against anyone. Anybody that wants to walk with us, they're more than welcome, and we even reach out to different tribes. You know, we have different tribes walk with us. We had some Indian people from over in the valley that walked with us, and it was really good to have them. They were like Maidu people and different other tribes.
And you're from what tribe, personally?
I was born and raised here in Round Valley, and I'm a Numlaki, and my father's side is up in Hoopaw, so I have, I have two tribes. I have the Hoopaw Valley tribe, and I got a Round Valley tribe. I'm pretty darn lucky.
Great. I also have in the studio with me here right now, Sandra Knight from the Machupta tribe. And Sandra, would you like to say anything about your experiences with Gnome Cult and how you support every year?
Sure. So I am the vice chair of the Machupta tribe, and we support the Gnome Cult walk each year with some safety measures on River Road for safety purposes. People drive awfully fast down that road, so we want to make sure everyone is safe on that road. We provide a lunch. We've provided dinners before, but it's just whatever the walkers need. We want to provide whatever they need. We've had many members do the walk over the years. I've only done the walk one time, and it is powerful, and it is significant. It's life changing to, you know, imagine that you're walking in the footsteps of your ancestors. And how hard it would have been for them. You know, when I walked, I'm in my Adidas, have my water pack, my Camelback on my back with plenty of water, plenty of food to eat, and support from all the walkers. But our ancestors did not have that. And it's a pretty powerful feeling to be doing exactly what they were forced to do.
Yeah, according to the history that I've read about it, you know, there were soldiers escorting them along the way, and you know, essentially people were being dragged and forced by the point of a bayonet as they were stumbling, and people were left behind that got weak, and you know, if they were able to get strong enough again, they would pick up and continue to walk. If not, they were just left behind to die, essentially.
Yeah, so the history is, it's an ugly history in California. Even the rounding up of the Indians at Chico Rancheria here in Chico on the Bidwell Ranch, they were corralled and there was no food. And to start the journey with no water and no food on day one, you can only imagine in your mind what they went through.
Yeah. Do either of you have anything else that you would like to say about the Gnome Cult?
I would like to make sure that everyone that comes out on this walk, they have to realize who we're walking for. We're walking for those ancestors. that's who we're paying our condolence to and remembering them. Some of us probably know who their ancestors were, like some families know who their grandfather was. And I only know of one person that my grandmother used to talk about, and that was a Dixie Duncan, because of a story she used to tell us, you know, sometimes that when he would start getting up there in age, that he would start telling them that he cried all the way over that hill. And that's the only things that I remember. And that, you know, and at a young age, when you see older people talking, kids, that you never really paid attention, because back in my day, when adults start talking, you had to be around.
Yeah, I mean, this happened just 160 years ago, so there's plenty of people still around that their great, you know, their great grandparents were very possibly part of that force march.
I need to remind people, it starts on Sunday, September 12th, and that is the longest day. It's 20 miles from Chico to Orland, basically, and further. But if people could be on the lookout for walkers on Highway 32, please be cautious of those walkers. They'll be on the walk for most of the day that day.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have some?
What I heard was that Sansa, they said they found a lunch place 10 miles from when we start, so I don't know where that's at. But.
I think he was just asking you if you knew anything about that. The lunch stop 10 miles in.
Oh, the lunch stop, yes. We provide the lunch, and hopefully we have to change the spot because of there's an orchard that we always stopped at, and the owner of the orchard isn't so accommodating anymore, so we had to find a new lunch spot. But Machupta Tribe will provide the lunch on the first day for the walkers.
Okay. So does that seem pretty good to you so far, Ronnie? Is there anything else you want to add? I'm going to stop recording for a second, just so we can just.
Okay, the recording stops there, and Ron Topi was the interviewer, and his main guest was Ronnie Hostler, who's a Round Valley elder, and also speaking with Sandra Knight, Vice President of the Machupta Tribe. Ron notified me that the Gnome Cult Walk will not be happening this year because the Forest Service has closed the forest. So once again, the 26th annual Gnome Cult Walk, Honor Their Memory, A Path Not Forgotten, Chico to Round Valley Indian Reservation Trail of Tears, is not occurring this year, but we can all be in memory of it. And thank you to Ron and his guests for that. For that important recording. Appreciate it. So you're listening to the Peace and Justice program. My name is Chris. I was hoping that I would be able to play you a little of Kathy Kelly. I'm going to go ahead and do that now. This was with permission from Roger Ruth, who did the recording, and I do think it's important since she spent so many years in Afghanistan with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Here you go.
Kathy Kelly. Revered and respected peace activist for decades. Thanks for taking some time to chat with me, Kathy.
Oh, well, thank you, Roger. It's always good to chat with you, and thank you for the invitation.
I know you have a lot of close relationships with people there. Tell me about what you know and what, you know, what you can share with people, and what, if anything, people can do to be helpful.
Well, what I know is that at least 35 youngsters believe they're at severe risk and are extremely anxious to leave Afghanistan, so much so that they finally, in the last several nights, have just took off for various borders, which is also a very dangerous thing to do. They, in a sense, the ones that I've been welcomed by over the years with wonderful hospitality, they shared everything they had and gave us a glimpse into their lives and the lives of their families. Because they were volunteers, really because of their idealism and their altruism, they didn't take salaries. They received quite a good deal of money from very generous people in the United States, and they developed projects to help people needier than they were. The widows who were saying, I can't feed my children. Many of those women were invited to make big, heavy blankets, which almost every woman in the rural areas of Afghanistan knows how to do. And then those blankets, the women were paid a minimum wage, and the blankets were given for free to people living in refugee camps. It was a brilliant project. And, you know, these kids were shivering out in the cold, distributing the blankets, going up icy mountain roads, trying to find out who were the most vulnerable widows living up near the mountaintops. I mean, they really taught me so much about living simply and sharing resources and finding realistic alternatives to war. But because they didn't have connections to USAID or large NGOs that, you know, might have paid them a wage if they'd known about them, possibly, I don't know. But they didn't have those connections, and so they're not on anybody's list to exit the country. But they are known in their neighborhoods, even in their home provinces, as people who've had lots of connectivity with Westerners. So they are very, very frightened. What can we do? I think that education remains crucial. It sounds like such an armchair sort of thing, but I've noticed that, you know, in the last, I guess, 2 weeks, almost 2 weeks, there's been far more attention paid to Afghanistan than was paid over the last 20 years. And so I think we need to keep on educating ourselves about what the realities have been for people in Afghanistan all through these years of U.S. war and occupation. It's just not true to say that the lives of people have been made better in cities, amongst some, that would be true. But for the majority of women and children in Afghanistan, they have suffered through malnutrition, serious malnutrition, anemia, drought, lack of clean water, livelihoods just not being available, and therefore tremendous bereavement as young men went off to find work carrying a gun for one warlord or another, and sometimes came back wounded or maimed or traumatized for life, as often happens with the United States veterans of combat. And then they're even less able to find work.
Okay, I have to cut that off there just because we have to get to a live guest here after the top of the hour. My name is Chris. The show is called Peace and Justice. We're on every Friday with rotating hosts, and I'm happy that you're with me today. Peace and Justice is made possible by generous contributions of all you KZFR supporters out there, and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico, and also Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when available at the Thursday night market and the Saturday farmers market. For more information, visit chicovelo.org and find them on Facebook. I'd also like to let you know about the Northern California Autism Symposium, which is returning Friday, September 24th, Chico State, presented
presenters will share the latest interventions, services, and supports available for individuals with autism spectrum disorder and their families. Information and registration is at NCAS. Of course, that is ncas.csuchico.edu. And lastly, I'd like to thank Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, which is family-owned, operated, and argued over since about 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves but drink with others. So it is just about on the nose here, noon. If I could speak. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'm going to play you a little Waylon Jennings, and then we're going to go to our first guest. Here we go. Okay, Waylon Jennings. I have on the line with me, I hope, Karen Kotowski. She is a retired lieutenant colonel from the U.S. Air Force, and her assignments included duties as a Pentagon desk officer in various roles for the National Security Agency. After retiring, she became a noted critic of the U.S. involvement in Iraq. Kotowski is known for her insider essays denouncing a corrupting political influence on military intelligence, especially leading up to the 2003 Iraq War. In 2012, she challenged incumbent Bob Goodluck in the Republican primary for Virginia's 6th District in the U.S. House of Representatives. In the Air Force, she wrote two books, Africa, African Crisis Response Initiative, Past, Present, and Future, and Expeditionary
Expeditionary Air Operations in Africa, Challenges and Solutions. She's featured in several documentaries, including Why We Fight from 2005, and she's written for LouRockwell.com since 2003. Her work has appeared in Salon and the American Conservative. She has an MA in government from Harvard and an MS in science management from the University of Alaska. And her PhD is in world politics from the Catholic University of America. Her thesis was titled Angola, a case study of the implementation of the Reagan Doctrine. She is a founding member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Welcome, Karen Kotowski.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you. You may be my first libertarian Republican guest in a very long time, but I am very, very, very happy to have you here because I think all of our voices matter right now as we're trying to understand and reflect what has happened to our country and to the people of the world that we have had at our effect for the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to start just by understanding you a little better. Can you talk about your early years, why you went into the Air Force, and you know, what kind of formed the basis of your yourself?
Well, I grew up in Western North Carolina in the mountains, and wanted to go to college, needed a scholarship, so I applied for some, and I got an Air Force RTC scholarship. So that got me into college, and from there, just one year led after the other, and you know, I got commissioned, and I served in the military for 20 years, and the first 10 of those years was during the Cold War, and the Cold War made it easy for people, at least the majority of the people, to kind of put things in black and white, you know, when it comes to defense. You know, we need a big military because they have a big military. You know, it was just bipolar world kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that made sense. And then after it ended, of course, I thought things would change in a much different way. In fact, you know, I expected NATO to fold after the Warsaw Pact did. There was no reason for NATO. That didn't happen. NATO expanded. You know, it found new missions, okay? And this is the kind of bureaucratic creep that we know about from organizational theory or whatever. But back home, we thought, well, we don't need bases everywhere around the world, but we still had them. And we were very reluctant to get rid of them. In fact, Germany had almost filed suit against us to get some of our bases gone. We just were so reluctant, you know, to adapt downward our overseas offense. Even though we had technically won, you know, in the sense, you know, we won the Cold War. I mean, I think people have heard that, very simplistic, of course, but it didn't result in what I expected. And so I started asking questions and reading and learning. And what I learned, of course, is, you know, that this has been a long-term trend, not just something in the last, you know, 20 years or in the last 30 or 40 years. This has been a trend since before the Civil War, when we first went west to, you know, to take property, and then in the turn of the century when we took over the Spanish Empire, at that point we were clearly an empire. If we hadn't been before, we were. So we've been an empire in this country since 1890s, but we don't call ourselves an empire. We call ourselves a republic. Some people call ourselves, you know, a democracy, but we're a constitutional republic. We call ourselves that, but we're not that. Yeah. We're an empire. And as I started learning more about history and how things evolved over time, then it became clear that that's what I was serving. I was serving in an imperial army, and it didn't make a lot of sense. And, of course, those last 10 years, of course, were post-Cold War, so I'm learning and reading and educating myself. And then, of course, we have 9/11. And after 9/11, we have this it was a huge excuse. It was the new Pearl Harbor, if you want to go with what the Project for New American Century had begged for, had prayed for, since the late 90s, you know, a new Pearl Harbor so that we can go to war with the backing of the American people. And a lot of times they would complain, well, we can't go to war like we want to because of Vietnam, you know, because that didn't work. The people got involved. We don't want the people involved in our wars. We want them to die in our wars, but we don't want them involved in the decision-making of our wars. So that seemed to be what was happening after 9/11. And, of course, Afghanistan is a decent-sized part of that, but it is not completely all of that because, you know, we've got troops right now nearly every country in the Middle East.
Right.
With the exception of Israel. I don't think Israel allows us to have troops there. They're one of the smartest countries in that regard. But the rest of them, whether they allow us or not, we have troops there.
Yeah. Yeah, we have over 800 military bases around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Karen Katowski, you were in a film called Why We Fight. It was devoted to proving President Eisenhower correct about the military-industrial complex and the need to create business once it started. And that's kind of what you've been telling us. Can you kind of give us an idea of that thesis and bringing it forward? Because it is so important for the American people to not be led by the nose again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true, and it's very difficult to change things because so much of our American economy, and not just now, it is true now, but it has been true for some time, and it was beginning to be true in even in Eisenhower's time. And of course, it's important to realize he gave that speech as his farewell speech. You know, he'd been in charge for 8 years, and had he been thinking about this? I'm certain that he had been thinking about it, but he hadn't been saying much about it because even then, the power of the military-industrial complex, the military-industrial congressional complex, was great, and it serves one master, and that master is itself and its bottom line, its financial bottom line. Not the Republic, not the Constitution, not national security. It serves itself, and so you have to be careful about criticizing it. Of course, he did criticize it on his last day in office. But that speech originally did include the drafts of it, included military-industrial congressional complex, because there's the political side to this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have our 435 or so districts, congressional districts, and two senators for every state. And you can't build an aircraft carrier without putting some of that acquisition money and that production money into every one of those districts. Every single one of those districts gets a piece of it. Every single one of those districts gets a piece of the F-35, that monstrous waste of trillions and trillions of dollars, which they just finally stopped after years of debating about it and continuing to spend money. Because that money, what does that money do? Well, we can say, well, it makes war and it kills people. Sure, it does that sometimes, although we haven't used the F-35. But what it does is it puts money back into the pockets of people by giving them jobs, because our biggest export is defense and security-related stuff, manufacturing and technology relating to defense. That's an offense. That's what we produce. And who produces that? Average Americans produce that. Union members produce that. People in small towns produce that. Contractors working from home produce that. Okay? And that money goes, Congress gives them the money, and the money then, obviously, it fills the rich pockets. We know that. But it also goes in to employ a lot of people in a lot of places where they don't have much else. And we say, well, they got to have jobs. They got to have jobs. Well, yeah, they do have to have jobs. But isn't it brilliant to create jobs that kind of tie people into, well, I got to have war, and I got to fight, and I got to have defense. We got to have a military. We got to worship the military. Because guess what? That's where my paycheck comes from.
All right.
So not good. It's not good. And it's like an iron triangle. It's a system that almost cannot fail, and it can fail. It can fail when the money runs out. It can fail if we're invaded and we lose. And obviously, that doesn't seem to be on the horizon. If the money collapses, if we go bankrupt, there's that possibility. You know, some people believe you can print money forever, but I don't think I would not bet on that. So there are things that can happen.
Yeah.
And you can have mass revolution. You can have people that wake up and say no. And I think that movie you're talking about, that documentary, is really helpful in doing that, because it's a very kind, it's very meaningful, but it's also very kind. I mean, he goes to these companies, that people that make missiles for a living, people that make packaging and for ammunition, you know, people that work on this stuff, and they're average regular people, and he says, do you like war? And they go, oh my gosh, no, I don't like war. But you make bullets for a living, you make missiles for a living, you make nuclear weapons for a living, but you don't like war. And he goes, yeah, see, that's a problem. It's a real problem. So people get it. You know, they get it. But we're kind of locked in many ways. So I don't know how. I don't really have I have some ideas. I don't have solutions for how you get out of that. Now, ideally, we do what has just happened, if you can believe the media, which I don't think we can. But it appears that we've pulled out our troops and some of our people, if not all of them, from Afghanistan. Okay, that's good. Should have done it 19 and a half years ago. But we have done that now. But look at what is happening, though. Look at what Washington and the military industrial complex are talking about. They're saying, well, we got to find new enemies, you know. So we got to put this money on the Pacific side. We got to put this money against this terrorism. This, I mean, Americans for the first time 2 weeks ago heard about ISIS-K. What the hell is ISIS-K?
Right.
Nobody knows. Doesn't matter. I can tell you one thing. The interest of ISIS-K and the interest of the defense industrial establishment in this country are identical, okay? You know, ISIS bombs soft targets, you know, did a suicide bomb and tried to shoot an airplane down as people are, as the Americans are leaving. Why? Who wins with that? Well, the Americans say, oh, my God, we got to stay because the Taliban can't handle it. And then what's ISIS saying? Hey, those Americans got to stay because otherwise we can't recruit. So they have shared interest. There's no doubt about it. I mean, if anybody's watched the Middle Eastern news over the past decade, every single time, I don't care if it was Obama, Trump, even Bush, if they ever said they were going to leave a place, next thing you know, we had an ISIS or an Al-Qaeda attack.
Yeah.
I mean, how convenient, right?
So, I know. It sounds jaded, but it's true. You know, I wanted to let our listeners know that you were at the Pentagon when it was bombed, when a jet flew into it. And I wanted to get your reflections or your thoughts or your feelings about that, because I've never met anybody who went through that. And I just, I feel like when we're coming around to 9/11, that we need to, you know, listen to the survivors, you know, because you have probably thought about this more than most of us.
Well, to some extent, but you got to realize the Pentagon is a massive building, takes a lot of acres. And I was a third of the way around it. So, yeah, we felt it. We felt the building shake at whenever it was, 10:30 or whatever. Felt the building shake, and from where we were, we could look out across the kind of center of the Pentagon. We were on the fourth floor. It's only five floors above the ground. So we could see the top roof, and we looked over there and saw a huge fireball blow out of the, blow out of the roof. But you couldn't tell what it was because we couldn't see any impact. We didn't have visibility into what flew into it or whatever, but so the huge fireball on the roof, and it could have come from above. You know, we didn't know what it was, but obviously we'd been watching television with the tragedy happening in New York. So somebody figured, you know, we're assuming it's something like that, and it's connected, right? Because after the second plane flew in, all the people in the military, you know how military people are. It's like, and actually normal people are. It's like, okay, this is not an accident. This is not random. You know what? This is connected, and so that's what people were thinking, and then, you know, basically, really screechy fire alarms and stuff you couldn't hear came over the intercoms, and nobody knew what it was, but we all got out. Everybody, you know, we locked up our safes and got out. I mean, a little bit of smoke, there's nothing. But we did lose people in the impact point, and I did know people that were there, and I this isn't my pain, but I have a friend who lost, basically, he was not in the building at the time, and he lost his whole office. So that was, he did nothing but funerals for a time there. Mm-hmm. So there's that, but everybody has pain, and the people in New York City, I think, not being military, not being your typical targets. I mean, military people kind of, in my opinion, you're in the military, you're wearing a uniform, you know, that's a target. Civilians is a different thing, and I think I don't know how the people coped with the losses and the tragedy that happened in New York.
Right.
But you know, for me, of course, you know, you asked the question why. It's also a little bit of the what, but you're always interested in the why. And for me, the why was really obvious because of the way our foreign policy had been for so long. And, of course, not the first terrorist attack. Terrorist attacks happen all the time in all kinds of countries. It's usually the weak. It's a weapon of the weak against the perceived strong. I mean, that's what terrorism is anyway, right? Because when the strong do terrorism, that would be us, you know, dropping bombs or, you know, lobbing drone attacks on wedding parties, you know, that's terrorism. But when the weak, when the strong do it, we don't call it terrorism, right? But when the weak do it, it's called terrorism. It's just fighting, you know. It's attacking. It's people that are angry beyond the point of discussion. And this country, America's foreign policy for years, had been filled with, you know, the kind of lying and hypocrisy and damage and basically rape of people's cultures and economies and environments, you know, for years. So, I mean, actually, the hard part would be to figure out who exactly wanted to do that, because there would be lots on that list. Now, of course, the mechanism, airplanes and things like that, obviously a little bit new. I will say this, unrelated, but you know, in the aftermath, in the few days after the after this happened, you know, they had talking heads on, and all the government people said, oh my God, nobody could have predicted this. Nobody could have predicted this. And I'm like, dude, you know, Tom Clancy wrote a book exactly like this, you know, about 10 years ago. We all read it. Because all the military people read Tom Clancy books, no doubt. And yet they would all say, oh, we could never imagine this. Nobody predicted this. And nobody, that's just totally, you know, it's off the wall. How did they think of this? And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe they read Tom Clancy. But whatever. It's so ludicrous. They lie. And it was, and then, of course, what bothered me more, and I only was in the military until 2003. I retired then. And what bothered me more, of course, is how 9/11 was used to conduct not just war overseas, but war domestically. You know, the Patriot Act is really, of course, most of it was, much of it was unconstitutional, so they modified it a little bit about 6 years after it was published, and then indemnified everybody who had violated the Constitution as a result of it, you know, just cover up, basically. But that Patriot Act is an act of war against the people in this country. It's a surveillance document. It is a banking privacy or lack of privacy document. It is a document that says if you want to move around in this country, and this is 20 years ago, if you want to move around in this country, you need to submit to TSA or whatever. You need to have your papers ready. I mean, this is homeland. What a German connotation that is. We've never had a homeland in this country, but now we have, you know, 20-year-old agency, Homeland Defense, you know, the Department of Homeland Defense. And so many things have changed, and what caused Americans not to pay attention to it closely was, of course, the crisis of 9/11, the panic and the fear. And people, the average person, you know, I'm interested in this kind of thing, and to some extent it was part of my job. But the average person is living their life. They don't have time to pay attention to every little thing, every little lie the government tells them. You know, they really hope the government leaves them alone for the most part, you know, unless they need something, and then they want it to be efficient. You know, they don't want it to, take over their lives. Nobody really wants that. So they don't pay close attention. So when something big happens, it's a prime point for propaganda. And, of course, that's what we heard much of, propaganda.
Let me stop you, Karen.
Around 9/11. Sure enough.
Yeah, I want to reintroduce you. This is the Peace and Justice Show on KZFR. I'm speaking with Karen Kotowski. She is a lieutenant colonel retired from the U.S. Air Force. And but we have like 4 minutes left, and I really want to ask you, you were a whistleblower regarding the war in Iraq and the corrupting influence of the Pentagon on intelligence and analysis. So I wanted, for the remainder of our time, for you to talk about that period and what you revealed and your concerns about that, because I'm just trying to get to some of this history today, and thank you.
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, I worked for in the Office of Secretary of Defense in Near East South Asia, which is covers Iraq and Iran also, and we co-shared office space with a newly formed Office of Political Appointees called the Office of Special Plans, and these guys were all, of course, not military people for the most part, but they certainly were ideological neoconservatives, and they spent their time, you know, working to do something with Iran and certainly to use Iraq as the staging point. So you had to get into Iraq and build bases and overthrow their government, and then from there you would go on to Iran. I mean, this was the agenda. But our problem with it, a lot of people that worked there who saw this, was that they would create talking points out of intelligence, cherry-picked intelligence and others. And it would be marked classified, and it would be controlled by that office so that it would be repeated in all kinds of briefings, both internal and external. And of course, it would frame things that often weren't true. And how did I know it was not true? Well, some of it was not true because we could tell what the source intelligence was. We knew it wasn't true. Other of it we could tell wasn't true because they would later retract it after the New York Times would say, hey, this wasn't true. Like the meeting, the so-called meeting between one of the folks in Prague, who supposedly met with one of the intel people of Saddam. That meeting didn't happen, okay? And we finally reported when the FBI wrote to the New York Times and said, please stop reporting this because it didn't happen. We know that it didn't happen because the guy you're talking about, we tracked him elsewhere at the exact same time. So unless he's in two places at the same time, this didn't happen. And they finally took it off of our talking points as a result of that inside the Pentagon. So who's driving the train here? Well, who was driving the train was the neocon, you know, the folks running this war, Doug Feist and Wolfowitz the recently deceased Rumsfeld. And those guys are running this thing, and they're shaping, their big objective is to shape, you know, American public opinion. So they're leaking intelligence, but of course, they're not leaking it with any, they're leaking it on purpose. I mean, they're providing selected bits of some true and some false information, and it's ending up on a routine basis in the New York Times, Washington Post, and it's shaping a narrative that is not true. And that narrative culminated in the infamous United Nations presentation by Colin Powell, right, who was reluctant for a long time, but finally went ahead and went with this stuff and talked about crazy things that within a year were on the mainstream news as being clearly not true, such relating to aluminum tubes, you name it. It was a lie. But it enabled us to engage in an invasion of Iraq, a toppling of Saddam Hussein, his murder, all with Americans cheering in the background. Because why? Because they had done 9/11, which of course we all know now, and we knew then, had they had not. So when I saw this, it's offensive to me as a human being. It's offensive to me as an Air Force officer. Okay, so, you know, I spoke out about it even while I was in uniform, and then I spoke out about it more when, of course, I retired. And luckily, thank God, I was close enough to retirement where I didn't have to stay long underground, so to speak. And I don't, you know, there are people that have risked far more than me who are whistleblowers, but I can say I'm definitely an eyewitness to a history and a methodology of how things are done in this country when this country decides it wants to go to war, and the country doesn't decide, an elite decides, and they do it. So,
Karen Kataski, I really appreciate that you spent this time with us today. I have one last question. It's something I read this morning. Our congressman said that the withdrawal from Afghanistan was disrespectful, dangerous, and un-American. What is your take in 1 minute about the U.S. withdrawal?
Well, above all things, it was overdue. And I do think it was poorly executed, and I think it was poorly executed by the Defense Department, by the Pentagon particularly, because they refused to call it a defeat. And if you call it a defeat, you blow up your equipment and you get your people out first. But if you don't call it a defeat, if you just call it a withdrawal or we're coming back later, which is what they wanted to do, I mean, you know, they've been fighting this, getting out of this for 15 years. The military has refused, the military brass has refused to get out. So they did a good job in the fact that they got out. Let's hope we don't go back in. Fingers crossed.
Thank you so much for your time today. It's really been enlightening. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Sure enough. Happy to be here.
All right. Bye-bye, Karen.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.
Okay, we are listening to the Peace and Justice program. I want to go ahead with a segue to my next guest, who is also retired military. And that would be just to forward promote something that my co-host Steve Chudy is doing. He is a saxophone player, and he plays with the Chico Little Big Band, and they are having their world premiere September 12th, 4 to 5, at the Butte Bible Fellowship, 2255 Cohasset Road. They are going to be playing some swing favorites, so listen in for that if you want to hear some big band music. And then also, I'm always worried about COVID and letting you know where we're at with that. On Tuesday, there were 145 new cases. That's the most recent that I was able to find for you. And there were 994 cases in the past 7 days. 96 people are hospitalized, 7 in the ICU. And so this is quite bad news. 8 people were confirmed COVID deaths in August. And there were 89 babies, 89 cases, 0 to 4 age range, and 254 in the 5 to 12 age range who are too young to be vaccinated. So I do hope people will choose vaccination. And lastly, I want to let you know that the Chico City Council meeting is on the 7th. You can go in and find out what the agenda is and see if there are important items for you. And the Board of Supervisors is very important. It's coming up on the 14th. Comments must be in by the 13th. So I will leave that at that, and I'm gonna just play this song in memory of Katrina. Some of the same things are being repeated in terms of New Orleans, and seems like a little neglect going on there. This is from Linda Allen singing "The News." Trina memory there for you. And this is the Peace and Justice Program, and I am delighted to have another important person who knows intimately about our history in this last 20 years. Her name is Colleen Rowley. She is a retired special agent and former Minneapolis Division Legal Counsel of the FBI, who taught constitutional law and law enforcement ethics to FBI agents and other law enforcement. Then she became a whistleblower about the FBI's pre-9/11 failures and the folly of the Iraq invasion. She was named, along with two other corporate whistleblowers, as Time Magazine's 2002 Persons of the Year. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, and Huffington Post, along with other publications. Ms. Rowley is also a senior fellow at the Eisenhower Media Network, an organization of independent veteran, military, and national security experts. Welcome, Colleen.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about the work that you did, the things that you know about in regards to Al-Qaeda before 9/11. There seems to have been, I was on Wikipedia today trying to, you know, understand a little bit more about, you know, who was doing what and when were they doing it. But you have links that go way back to 1996. Do you want to talk a little bit about what led up to 9/11, please?
Okay. It's going to be a challenge to say this so quickly, because there are books and books and documentaries out there. And even with all of that information, guess what? They still have not uncovered all of it.
Right.
There was a lot of cover-up after 9/11 and use of shock doctrine and the trauma in order to use it as a pretext in order to launch the wars in the Mideast. But we still have not uncovered all of the truth of it. Like I said, there's lots of books, and sometimes they're trying, a lot of the documents were blacked out, and or have been withheld. So some of these researchers and historians are trying through Freedom of Information to get these things. The 9/11 families who are suing Saudi Arabia in New York City, 20 years it's taken them. And they have amassed a lot of information. However, they're still being thwarted. They've been thwarted all this time. It's amazing that we can't get to the bottom of the truth of something so horrible. But I will just try real quickly. So people do know about Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor for Clinton, who had this idea that he could trap the Soviet Union in Afghanistan and use proxy forces, which is kind of a standard method of operation, you know, using dissident groups and proxy forces in Afghanistan to fight against the Soviets. And those proxy forces, however,
were the jihadists, some of them from Saudi Arabia and other places, that included, was really kind of headed up by Osama bin Laden. Also, the Chechen terrorist group were very closely aligned because they were fighting also against the Soviets. So we used those forces, including bin Laden and what became the Taliban, what became Al-Qaeda. And they were working for us. We armed them and we funded them. There's you know, PBS documentaries about that. There's a movie, Charlie Wilson's War. Now, the thing that people don't recognize when they watch that movie, Charlie Wilson's War, is it has a happy ending. Charlie Wilson gets an award from the CIA for funneling weapons through Pakistan into these warlords and Mujahideen, and eventually, you know, it helps topple the Soviet Union. So he gets an award for that. Now, what you don't see is the aftermath. And all of these things have consequences and blowback. So bin Laden, at a certain point after this, becomes angry, probably for a whole range of reasons. One thing, I think, was Israel, what's going on with the Palestinians. There's more than one reason. But one reason was that that first Gulf War in whatever it was, 91, 92, he offered Saudi Arabia to you know, fight for them. But Saudi Arabia more or less picked the United States to, you know, launch that first war on Iraq in the early 90s. And then U.S. troops were stationed in Saudi Arabia. Well, that was against, you know, that didn't make Al-Qaeda happy. There started to be terrorist incidents even inside Saudi Arabia. So in 95, there were some bombings in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Then in 96, here's the horrible thing that happened in 96. And I have some direct personal experience with this because one of the victims was from Minnesota. There was a big, large bomb that went off outside an Air Force dormitory called Khobar Towers that killed 19 airmen and wounded and injured over 300. And at the time, of course, the Saudis were our allies, so the United States will never, and again, this is always the case, they cover up things that, you know, to protect allies, and this has happened throughout history. And so Louis Free allowed the Saudis, the Saudi government, and this was through torture, they tortured confessions out and stuff, and also they executed people that were the actual, you know, they would have been the actual sources and witnesses. They quickly executed them. But then he allowed the Saudi regime to tell him who to indict as being responsible for the Khobar Towers. And, of course, the Saudis, their enemy, their rivals and enemies are the Shia, Hezbollah, Iranian-connected Shia minority, which, frankly, it would may have made no sense for them to have been responsible. There was no shred of evidence except for some tortured confessions. And even the DOJ at the time refused to go along with Louis Free initially on this. And eventually, on his last day in office, just 2 months before 9/11, he was able to get the indictment of these 12, false indictment, I should say, of 12 Shia, Iranian-connected figures for this bombing that killed 19 people in Khobar Towers. At the time, I didn't know it was that bad. When I wrote my memo in May of 2002 about the things I knew in our office, just in our Minneapolis office, about the leading up to 9/11, I said, you know, I didn't really even know the half of it, how bad it was, because it's so much more extensive than what was in my memo of May of 2002.
And that's
there was all kinds of...
Yeah, that's what you're best known for, Colleen Rowley, is for this whistleblowing when you sent your memo to Robert Mueller and then about Zacharias Moussaoui. I'm sorry if I don't say it right, but can you talk about what you revealed and why you did it?
Well, there were many clues before 9/11, and the Moussaoui one was a major one. Also, the CIA, unbeknownst to anyone, was tracking the Al-Qaeda terrorists for 2 years, including monitoring a major summit meeting of Al-Qaeda in, I think, 2000 in Kuala Lumpur. Now, they never shared that information with the FBI or the, I don't know about the NSA, but they didn't share it with the FBI. Then they even knew, there's not a lot of evidence that George Tenet, the director of the CIA, knew this and others, that two of the hijackers, two of the men who would become the hijackers had come into California. There's all kinds of murky, this is an area that they haven't uncovered, but there's all kinds of murky stuff about whether the CIA was trying, to, what they were trying to do. There's also murky things about the Saudis, some Saudi characters who are funding and aiding and supporting those two hijackers in California. But that information was not shared with the FBI. Also, the information, a Phoenix agent noticed that there were all these terrorist suspects in flight school. So those were three of the main things that, you know, if they had been investigated properly, and if even if the information had been read, it's that basic. There are memos that go to top echelon people with the names, you know, their actual names are on the memo. And after, when they had the official investigations afterwards, the 9/11 Commission, the Joint Intelligence Committee, the Inspector General things, they all said, oh, no, I didn't see the memo. So it's failure. When I wrote this memo, you know, I emphasized failure to share information. But the 9/11 Commission actually then, 3 years later, verified that it was a quote-unquote failure to connect the dots. And so it was a failure to share information inside agencies. In the Mousawi case, the agents knew from the start in mid-August that they had discovered a terrorist suspect. They knew this from the start. And yet after 9/11, the FBI director, Robert Mueller, said, there's no way, no one knew any of this. We couldn't have prevented 9/11. I mean, he was saying the opposite.
Yeah.
But they knew from the start, and they had this very multi-page declaration for an emergency search of Mousawi's belongings. And if they had conducted the search, they would have found he was connected to the other part of the group, the other hijackers. They were being paid by the same guy who worked for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. It's detailed, but they would have found this out right away. And that might have prevented it itself, just by allowing to have the search. Secondly, if they would have connected it with the Phoenix memo about flight schools, then they would have gone to the flight schools and found other suspicious, like Mohammed Atta, who was the ringleader of the actual hijackers. And the third thing was they should have warned. Actually, there was a warning that went to the Federal Aviation Administration even before 9/11. Why? Because our agents insisted if you have terrorist suspects learning to fly, you have to warn the airlines that they have to shut their cockpit doors and there cannot be access to the cockpit. It's pretty basic. You didn't need to launch wars on six or seven countries in the Mideast and claim you were bringing democracy and all this. You needed to do some really basic things, fix the bureaucracy so that we don't have this lack of information sharing. And then finally, besides the information that wasn't shared between agencies, the CIA kept everything quiet and didn't tell the FBI when terrorist suspects had come into the U.S. Besides that, the 9/11 Commission went even further and said if information had been shared with the public, that would have prevented 9/11.
Right.
For starters, you know, most people flying on airlines would have demanded that they shut the cockpit doors for starters if they'd known this. There's a lot of things that could have been done, but instead, the powers that be, or the powers that shouldn't be, had a prior agenda, which was to launch war on Iraq and Syria and Iran and Yemen and all of these countries in the Mideast. And that, of course, as we well know now, has turned into a horrible debacle and has actually increased terrorism worldwide.
Right.
It's absolutely backfired royally, and this was the worst choice. But at the time, people were so traumatized that they used this psychological shock doctrine to get everyone to go along with it.
Yeah.
Colleen, Colleen Raleigh is an FBI staff attorney, or was, and she has an important part in the efforts by whistleblowers to come forward and to reverse this history that we have now lived through for the last 20 years. And I just want to read this, Colleen. It'll just take a minute. 20 years of the U.S. war and occupation in Afghanistan cost at least $2.26 trillion and resulted in the deaths of more than 2,300 Americans and tens of thousands of Afghan civilians. The war on terror George Bush launched with his Operation Enduring Freedom has included the torture and abuse of untold numbers of people in Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo, and CIA black sites. The Bush administration began bombing Afghanistan on October 7, 2001. And in less than a month after the September 11th bombings, the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the U.S.-led NATO invasion of Afghanistan violated the U.N. Charter, which does not permit the use of military force for retaliation. The Charter mandates the countries settle their disputes peacefully using diplomatic means. On October 15, 2001, the Washington Post reported President Bush rejected an offer from Afghanistan's ruling Taliban to turn over suspected terrorist mastermind Osama bin Laden to a neutral third country, as an eighth day of bombing made clear that military coercion, not diplomacy, remained the crux of U.S. Policy toward the regime. And in late 2001, Taliban leader Mullah Omar approached Hamid Karzai, who shortly thereafter became interim president of Afghanistan, in order to negotiate a peace deal. The U.S. also rejected that overture. The charter says that a country can use military force only when acting in self-defense or with permission of the U.N. Security Council. Neither of these preconditions were present. And I wanted to get your response to that, to all of this that we've been through. It must be so hard as an insider to, you know, as someone who tried to stop it, to be at this place looking back. What are your reflections?
Yeah. And you tried to stop it in different junctures, you know, because once something gets rolling, you can't just say, well, this can go on forever. You know, Pete Seeger had that famous song in during the Vietnam War about waist deep in the big muddy.
Yep.
And this inclination that once you've started something, you can't look back. Obama said that about torture. Once, you know, you have a torture program going on, he said, never look back, just keep going forward. So, I mean, to be honest, that's kind of a psychopathic notion that you can't fix any problem. If you've had done something wrong, it can't be fixed. You just have to continue on. And so we have had 20 years, and all, you mentioned that the Taliban has even tried to give up, and they've rejected it because they wanted to have this war, and they wanted to have all of this toppling, because that was a prior plan. It was a prior agenda. It had nothing to do with the facts. They exploited incidents and actually misinformed about the actual truth of these incidents in order to get that opportunity to go forward. But it's been excruciating to watch all of these terrible things, all of them illegal, by the way. Torture is completely illegal. Mass surveillance, even of Americans, drone assassination, and launching wars of aggression, funding proxy groups now in Syria that were terrorists as well. It's the very same mistake as we made in Afghanistan, we made in Syria. Saudi Arabia sent jihadists to try to topple the Assad government. So it's we're just continue. It's like there's no, partially because of our very powerful military-industrial complex that has made trillions of dollars off of this. And I know you mentioned, I see these figures where they cite, a quarter of a million deaths in Afghanistan. But if you take all of the Mideast, mm-hmm. and then all of the, even the refugees that have drowned in the Mediterranean, all of the disease and starvation in Yemen, if you take all of these war consequences in, it's millions of people now,
yes.
that have been killed in the post 9/11 wars. We have killed, and I'll just mention one more terrible thing about this. When there was this, when they tried to get Obama to carpet bomb Libya, without, again, make it up. There was no factual justification for this. And Hillary Clinton and these other two women were the ones that were pushing it. They were actually, they were arguing with the defense secretary at the time who didn't want to do it. But they prevailed. But at the time, they bombed for like 90 days or something. And then the War Powers Act means that it goes to Congress. And there were some people in Congress who said, you know, this isn't right. It's a terrible thing. We need to have we need to have a hearing at this point. And then the Congress gets to decide, because that's what the law is. And at the time, the legal advisor to Hillary Clinton, he was the Yale Dean of Law School. His name was Harold Koh, K-O-H. He gave the advice that if we merely are aerial bombing, drone bombing or carpet bombing foreign people, that it doesn't really count as war. He said that doesn't fit the definition of war because we won't have any casualties. We're only killing foreign people. That argument was made to Hillary Clinton. And I think it kind of prevailed at the time, but also the carpet bombing was ending anyways. But if you think about it, if the United States can now, you talk about wars of aggression, well, if it's merely drone bombing and aerial bombing, could even be nuclear bombing, and there's no chance of an American casualty, because that's the mindset now. That was an official mindset. Then what is it? Of course, they don't say what it is. If it's not war, if you're merely killing foreigners, what is it? Mm. Well, it's just murder at that point.
Right.
You know, which is also completely illegal.
So
all
Colleen,
of these things have been illegal, and they have not helped our reputation in the world.
Yeah.
You know, we're trying to be an empire and be the, you know, we hear all these political speeches. We have to lead the world because we're the only exceptional nation, blah, blah, blah. You hear all those, you know, kind of lofty speeches. But our acts have undercut that, immensely undercut it.
Yes.
So a lot of countries in the world are not looking up to the United States anymore after everything that's happened.
So, Colleen Rowley, we have about 4 minutes left, and I wanted to just ask you about this. So Senator Minority Leader Mitch McConnell released a statement calling on the U.S. to redouble our global efforts in the war on terror in response to attack, you know, at the airport in Afghanistan, seizing the opportunity to promote more, we fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here. And then the Biden administration continues to kill people as they pulled out of Afghanistan to do these retaliatory strikes and end up killing families. What is your take on the way forward? I think you know what needs to happen, and we need to hear it.
I heard McConnell on the television, and I almost threw something at the television when I heard him saying this. At the same time, he's saying that we have to redouble the so-called global war on terror. The Biden's first strike, that he's under pressure now to show that he has this revenge. They're accusing him of being weak. And, you know, he's getting so much pressure from that side, the war hawk side. And it's not just Republicans, it's Democrats too, and certainly the Pentagon. A whole range of powers in D.C. have aligned to pressure him, and then, of course, he does what he's supposed to do, which is he sends a drone strike or some kind of bomb, and, of course, it killed children. So at the same time, you know, McConnell thinking this is going to help to, quote-unquote, redouble our efforts. At the very same time, what you did is you killed innocent children. I mean, and there's very few people who are adding, you know, again, connecting the dots. You know, if it, you know, back to Pete Seeger's song, if it doesn't work, you should turn around and head back when you are waist deep and eyeball deep. I would say we're eyeball deep now. You know, at this point, you know, and the big fools say to push on. And, of course, Biden should not be listening to these big fools who say to push on. This is the point where you really should learn the lessons of the last 20 years. After Vietnam, there was something called the Vietnam Syndrome, where a lot of true facts came out, and people did, for a little while, learn something. And there was this, you know, little few years, it wasn't that long before Bush was able to say, I overcame the Vietnam syndrome and I started another war. We can be back on the war path after this. So, but I'm hoping that, you know, this is the educational part, because if people don't understand in the United States, a president will feel compelled to go with the powers that are pushing him, the military industrial, big media, congressional, think tank, all of these things that are combined now as this major war profiteering force. That's what it is. It's a war profiteering force. It's very, very powerful. Eisenhower, you know, if he'd only known how bad, he'd be rolling over in his grave.
Yeah, that's for sure. So, Colleen Raleigh, we have like a minute left, and I don't know what you wanted to cover in this last minute since it seems important, but it seemed like you were saying then that all of us who care need to be countering this hawkish momentum to push Biden into a more hawkish position. Is this correct?
I mean, I think a lot of this is people want to believe. So when they do have, you know, all these figures, everybody from Madeleine Albright, you know, they often use figures like women, Condi Rice, Susan Rice. They use minorities and women, Colin Powell. They're doing this for a reason, because people want to believe and trust. And right now, honestly, the number one thing is nobody should be, there's been such a track record now at this point of almost constant lying. And these are blatant lies. Everything from about the waterboarding and the torture. I mean, they're just blatant. I'm frankly surprised that people still do trust at this point. Everything that's coming out where they make up a casus belli for more war, they're doing it on China, the nuclear superpowers, China and Russia. Everyone should be skeptical and say, you know what? I want evidence and proof. They shouldn't be saying, well, I trust him because he's a Republican, or I trust her because she's a Democrat. You shouldn't be doing that. You should be demanding proof of everything coming out of Washington, D.C. at this point.
Well, spoken as a true retired FBI agent, I appreciate this guidance. I think it's really important what you've been saying, Colleen Raleigh, and I appreciate your time today on the Peace and Justice program, too. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. All right, another Peace and Justice program. A lot to chew on there. It's been a rough 20 years, and especially for those who have been at the effect of all of our wars and deeds. And so I hope that you can use that information. I really do, and that you'll become involved and to, you know, to kind of counter some of this push to to go forward with more of the bad policies that we've been having over these last years. It's very important right now. If we don't curb it now, the military-industrial complex, as you know, is the biggest polluter in the world, with 800 bases all around the world. We basically are trying to be an empire, and it is bankrupting our country. We will not be able to stop climate change if we do not fund the things that need to be done on the civilian infrastructure end of things. It has to stop. So anyway, that's just my opinion here at KZFR, and I love you all. So let me just say thank you to our underwriters and get out of the way for playing dead so you can unwind and relax with Bree Lager. It's going to be a great show. I want to thank all of you supporters out there who help us run the station, and Chico Custom Cabinetry, creating cabinetry for kitchens, bathrooms, and more. Chico Custom Cabinetry is licensed and bonded, works with all budgets, and offers initial consultations and estimates. Details at Chico Custom Cabinetry. com on Facebook, and at 324-0032. If you can dream it, they can build it. And also Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. And for details, see SquareDealMattress.com. We're going to go now to the community calendar. And please stay well. Wear your mask. Peace.
Hey, KZFR. Welcome to Local Updates with Megan. After enduring such unprecedented times, it's our main goal here at KZFR to bring you updated information daily to keep the Zephyr strong and safe. The Dixie Fire has been active for 44 days now, and as of yesterday, is 45% contained. It is still affecting the five counties of Butte, Plumas, Lassen, Shasta, and Tehama. Winds calmed after sunset last night, but the fire remained active well into the night. Spotting and torching was limited to areas in and around Lassen Park, with fire burning in a number of remote areas with limited access and steep and rugged terrain. Temperatures today are expected to increase with decreasing winds from the north and northwest, with an increase in temperature over the weekend. NorCal has experienced large fire activity and will likely experience an extended fire season. Fires burning here are exhibiting extreme fire growth based on critical fuel conditions. Certain evacuation orders have been reduced to warnings, and certain warnings have been lifted, allowing some residents to return to their homes and businesses. Returning residents are strongly encouraged to stay vigilant with regard to current fire conditions. You can check the evacuation orders and warnings that are constantly being updated at www.fire.ca.gov. Thanks for staying informed. We'll see you tomorrow on the Local Updates on KZFR.
All righty, just a second or two before 1 o'clock, time for Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead. Every Friday afternoon from 1 to 3, my name's Ray Lager. It's always nice to be in here. Got a nice show for you today, 3981 MSG, Madison Square Garden, New York City. Got Althea coming up for you if you're out there, Tim. So stay tuned for that. Let's thank our underwriters, and we'll get right to the program. We want to thank Jeep Trail Print Shop, a small local Chico screen printer that loves great design, small businesses, musicians, educators, and creative customers. Jeep Trail Print Shop specializes in water-based screen printing to bring your vision to life. More information at 530-415-6244 or at jeeptrailprint.com. And by M&M Real Estate, offering a caring, comprehensive approach with efficient service, straightforward communication, and transparency. More information about buying or selling your home.